Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. Retired U.S. Army Brigadier General Don Bolduc, Republican of Stratum, is hoping to win his party's primary in September and challenge Democrat U.S. Senator Jeanne Shaheen in the general election this fall. We'll spend the first part of the program today with General Bolduc and then turn to some of the week's news. And your comments and questions are welcome, of course. You can send them by email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. General Bolduc joins us now by Zoom. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, sir, it's an honor to be with you. Thank you. And I wish the best to all your listeners.
Thank you very much. So given the national conversation we're having now about race, racism, and equity, we wanted to start the program by asking you about one specific action you plan to take if elected to combat systemic racism, whether it's in housing policy, education, healthcare, or criminal justice.
Well, thank you very much for that question. As you know, I served 33 plus years in the United States military. One of the most diverse organizations in the country, and the organization that was the, you know, first to desegregate in our country back in 1948. And so I don't look at people by the color of their skin, their religion, their sex, their orientation. I look at them as through a lens of the quality of their character, content of their character, the quality of the type of person that they are, and the contribution that they make. So what I plan on doing when I go to Washington, D.C., is bring that kind of positive leadership to the U.S. Congress, which I believe is lacking. We have ineffective leaders there that don't know how to get past their differences. And this is what America needs. America does need, I believe, some changes in the education system and the criminal justice system, and so that we educate our children better, and we have a just law and order system that's fair across the board, regardless of who you are. But more importantly, we need leaders that deliver a message of unity, leaders that deliver a message of accountability and responsibility and transparency and build trust. And if we can do that, that will be the number one thing that gets over it. When I have the diverse organizational structure in my commands that I had, all the way up from a squad leader as a sergeant to a division level, commander in the U.S. military. It is all about treating people fairly and being transparent with them and taking care of them. And that's what we need to do in America. And that's the message. And that's the kind of environment that we must create. It is really, I think, the root cause of our problems.
And do you support the Black Lives Matter movement?
I support the Everyone Lives Matter movement.
What does that mean? Because I'm not familiar with that movement. I'm hesitant to say it even exists. Are there marches for all lives?
It doesn't exist, and that's the problem. And I think when we categorize people and we put things in stovepipes, we're channeling ourselves in a way that's very divisive, because nobody's going to be able to understand each other. The big thing is about understanding. I don't care if you're a Republican, Independent, Democrat, Libertarian, whatever you are. I don't care if you're Black, White, Asian. It doesn't matter. We are in this together. Mm-hmm. Nobody gets out of life alive. And we need to realize that if we're going to achieve life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, and help each other, we have to do it together. And we have to overcome our differences, whether it is appearance, whether it's sex, whether it's religion. It doesn't matter.
But are there not problems specific to the Black community that you think Black Granite Staters would want you as a senator to address?
Yes, what they want me to address is the fact that their color of their skin doesn't matter, and it's the content of their character that matters.
But are there not problems that are specific to people of color in New Hampshire and Black people in New Hampshire that are worthy of addressing, in your view, specific to those folks?
Sure. We wouldn't be having this conversation if there wasn't, racism existing in our nation, in our country, among groups and among individuals. And it requires education. It requires us to stand shoulder to shoulder and to look past all those differences. I don't think there's a program that you can create or a law that you can pass or legislation that you can do. These are ideas. These are things about fairness and developing trust and about a moral consciousness that our country has to overcome to include our state. And where we see it, we need local leaders and state leaders and federal leaders and people that are leaders in the community, lawyers and doctors and teachers. We need to beat this back in the classroom. And if we're not willing to do that and stand up for others and fight for others, which is what I did in my career for 33 plus years, then we're not going to go anywhere. There's no specific program out there, law or legislative agenda, that is going to get over there. It is about people. And people will fix this problem.
There have been calls in recent weeks to take down Confederate statues and monuments in many communities across the country. There's some concerns here in New Hampshire about, for example, a statue of Hannah Duston. President Trump's, when it comes to removing some of these monuments, what are your thoughts on the removal of such monuments?
So my thoughts are, first and foremost, I make a plea to everybody not to vandalize anything. Whether it's statues, businesses, anything. It's the wrong thing to do, and it's the wrong approach. So please, let's not do that. If you have an issue, intelligently and articulately, bring that issue forward, and we can have a debate about it. I am concerned about erasing our history as well, because if we erase history, then we forget what we've learned from history and how we moved forward. This country, in my opinion, and I've been to 3/4 of the countries of the world, and I've worked inside them, and I've worked in countries that needed to heal through civil war. And the reasons that they didn't heal properly and they continued their violence well after the civil wars is because they forgot about the history. They forgot about what got them there. They didn't move forward. They didn't try to forgive. They didn't try to codify the reasons why they got into this situation and why they ended up killing each other, just like in our Civil War. And sure, if we need to take a look at statues and move them into museums, or we have to do other things in order to be able to move forward as a country, we should do that, but we should do it peacefully. We should do it collectively, and we should do it with the consensus of everybody.
And is that what you would approve of, moving Confederate statues, for example, out of public settings and into museums? Would you support that?
Well, I really have to look at this. It's the nature of the community. It's the nature of the geographical area of our country. You know, one of the things that our Reconstruction did, although it was not perfect, as you know, we study it, it allowed our country to heal. And we recognized heroes on both sides in order to move forward. We didn't disarm on both sides.
Heroes on both sides, one side being a rebel side.
One side being a rebel side. Listen, we deal with it in our own military history, right? We had, I believe, 241, I may be off a little bit on number, but 241 West Point graduates that were officers fought for the Union. Another 141, I believe, or so fought for the Confederacy, right? And we still honor West Point as our premier military institution and place that produces our officers today. If we dwelled on the fact that some fought for the Confederacy and some fought for the Union, and we didn't get past that, Our military wouldn't be as strong as it is today. We wouldn't have the United States Military Academy. We wouldn't have that opportunity to develop leaders. We wouldn't have the Naval Academy. We wouldn't have the U.S. Air Force Academy, the Maritime Academy, the Coast Guard Academy. So we got to get past these things and move forward.
I want to ask you something related to the pandemic, because this pandemic is not the first that we've seen. Probably won't be the last. So assuming there will be another one, how can we as a country better prepare for the next one?
Well, you know, there is no question that we were unprepared for this, and we were unprepared for it on many, many levels. First of all, I think a real audit and a real investigation of the CDC and where their money goes, what they do with it, and how they're organized and how they're preparing nationally for this. We need to look into the Federal Emergency Management Administration and see how they're doing things. And we need to bring manufacturing back to the United States from outside the United States. That is key for us to be able to respond to pandemics, so that we're not waiting for and spending millions and billions of dollars paying other countries for equipment that we allow them to manufacture for us overseas. And we need to do a real good look and a real good accounting of what that will require in order for us to get strong. The other thing that we need to do is take advantage of the things that we saw, you know, emerge from this that we didn't foresee before or weren't leveraging before. One of them is telemedicine. One of them is expanding our broadband internet, particularly here in New Hampshire, so that it is wide, the breadth and depth of it, you know, from top to bottom and bottom to top. Is in place, and we don't have any issues, and we can readily transition to whatever we need to do. We need to leverage the creation and the creativity we've seen in how we use our workforce and how we commute to work, and who needs to be in work, and who needs an office, who doesn't need an office, who can work at home. I think we need to look seriously at the flexibility and options that we have for teaching our children. Mm-hmm.
Would you be in favor of a mask wearing mandate?
A mask wearing? No, I would not. I would not. I am unapologetically of the opinion that the masks cause more problems than they solve.
How so?
Well, I believe that they collect bacteria. I believe that that they get dirty. I believe that people use the same mask over and over and over again, and they don't change it. They don't change it out. We've had a huge littering problem with masks and rubber gloves, and that's creating a problem.
And do those problems outweigh the scientific benefits, in your view, espoused by people like Dr. Fauci, for example, who say that the mask prevents the spread of a deadly disease?
Listen, I'd never get into a scientific argument with Dr. Fauci, but I listen to other people outside of Dr. Fauci, and I do believe that the masks in the proper setting, like hospitals, are necessary. But outside of hospitals, I believe that they're ineffective. They're not made of the right material in many cases. They don't breathe, adequately. It's not going to do what we want. Social distance, wash your hands, keep your places clean, clean up after yourself. All these things that we should have been doing in the first place mm-hmm. are more effective than mandating the wearing of a mask.
Can I ask you about healthcare? Because you've said that the Affordable Care Act is a bureaucratic mess. Republicans in Congress have been pushing for its repeal. The ideas of what would replace it have been few and far between. Do you think it should be repealed? And if so, what should replace the Affordable Care Act?
So the Affordable Care Act has some things in it that we need to keep. First of all, prenatal to postnatal care, pre-existing injuries, I think are, you know, hugely important. And if you're going to change healthcare in the United States, you need to change the whole idea and paradigm. And I've talked to a lot of doctors and nurses and medical professionals about this, because I'm not an expert. I'm going down there to represent people to do the best thing we possibly can because quite frankly, the big problem with healthcare in our state is it's the number one cause of bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy. And we owe people of New Hampshire and people of America a healthcare system that's not going to bankrupt them. And that's the problem. And I think in large part, that problem is because the government controls too much of it. And we need to get the government out of it, deregulate it, and privatize it, and make it more competitive so we drive prices down, you know, so on and so forth. You know, those kind of things. I think we need to change the way we view healthcare in this country and make healthcare and make good health something that we value. Is there
a way that you can name that would explain how you would drive the cost of healthcare down to prevent those bankruptcies you're worried about? How would you do it?
Yeah, sure. Well, first and foremost, if you want to drive, you know, the cost down for healthcare, you have to do a couple of things. One, you have to have more choices, and more choices lead to more competition. That drive costs down. That's not available in the current healthcare system. I think that we need to get control of the out of control money making pharmaceutical businesses. It's out of control, and we need to drive those prices down. We need to make it affordable. I just talked to a woman the other day whose insulin is almost the cost of it is prohibitive. It doesn't make any sense. She can, you know, we can get it. Other countries pay $8 to $10 for insulin, and we end up paying $800 for insulin. I mean, that is just, you know, that is wrong.
So are you thinking of a regulation, a government regulation that would help bring the cost of prescription drugs down?
Yeah, I think if we stop allowing pharmaceuticals to control our political system, at the benefit of politicians in Washington, D.C., that's going to go a long way, right? A lot of them are benefiting from the special interest and lobbyists of big pharmaceutical companies. I think we do need reform in order to be able to drive these costs down. That only makes sense. We have to have more flexible plans, like, for instance, auto insurance, right? We need to go from disease management to health management, and we need to reward good health all the way through somebody's health. And if we do that, if we change from disease management, a pill for every ill, and we manage your health, we're going to have a much healthier society, and we're going to have much lower costs because people aren't going to be pushing the easy button and going to the emergency room for everything. That costs a lot of money. The other thing that we're not making premium in our healthcare is dental care, gum disease, oral health. It is so important. It reduces heart disease, diabetes, osteoporosis, rheumatoid arthritis, heart attack, stroke. And we need to put an emphasis on that. Among our veterans, dental care is a huge problem, right? And in our society. And we need to look at how we're maintaining our health and prioritize that inside a private system that requires competition, because a free market system will deliver lower prices.
General Bolduc, can I ask you a question? Since you mentioned veterans and we've been talking about healthcare, you've been very open about your own struggles with post-traumatic stress. What more could the Department of Veterans Affairs be doing to help veterans struggling not just with post-traumatic stress, but with any ailment?
Well, I think that the first thing that the Veterans Administration needs to do is get control of veterans care across the board. They're missing the boat. Their bureaucracy is too big. They're ineffective. You talk to any administrator in just about any veteran medical facility inside communities, and you'll find that the bureaucratic structure is what gets in the way, and ineffective leaders. And so what I want to do when I get to Congress is sit on the Senate Veterans Committee, and I want to roll up my sleeves and get to work on this huge bureaucracy that we have across Department of Defense, Veteran Affairs, Department of Labor, and Department of Housing and Urban Development, and make sure that money is inside a system to protect our veterans and deal with the problems into the communities without all this, infrastructure and bureaucracy that gets in the way. I want the Veteran Affairs out of the primary care business. They are ineffective, and this is a big change.
Even though most veterans overwhelmingly find that they are quite happy with the services that they get at the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Well,
you still believe that?
I still believe it, yes, because I talk to veterans not only here but all over the country. And yeah, sure, there are veterans out there that are happy with the care they get, but there are veterans that are not happy with the care they get. And there are horror stories that I deal with every single day as part of my wife and I's veteran advocacy that we do. And I can tell you that the Veteran Affairs, you know, the medical, the people that work there are awesome. They want to do great jobs for our veterans. I see it every day. I get all my care at the Manchester VA, but it's not enough. And I got a clinic right down the street from me here that I can't go to because it's not on the VA list, mm-hmm. right? So I have to travel further for, you know, something I may need and I can get less than a mile away from my house. So the veteran healthcare isn't what it should be. The VA isn't delivering the level of primary care to our veterans that they should. And they're not dealing with the root causes of suicide. With 60,000 suicides between 2008 and 2018, excuse me, we're not getting there. And we need to privatize this so that we get it closer to home. They don't have to go anywhere. They can do it. And we can save our government a tremendous amount of money. The VA needs to be involved in veteran issues, but not down at that level.
Retired U.S. Army Brigadier General Don Bolduc.
Appreciate it, and I look forward to coming back. Thank you.
All right. We're speaking with candidates in a variety of races ahead of the September 8th primary. Hear previous conversations and stay up to date with new ones by subscribing to the Exchange podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, or check out nhpr.org. Still to come, Governor Chris Sununu announced the state's guidance for reopening schools in the fall. We'll take a look at the details, and if you've got questions, call now, 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, and today we're taking a look back at the week's news, and we're going to turn now to take a look at the governor's plan for reopening schools. If you've got a question about what this might mean for your city or town, email exchange at nhpr.org or call us now so we can get your question on the air. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. And we'll turn now to NHPR education reporter Sarah Gibson, who's been covering this. Sarah, thanks for being here.
Hi, you're welcome.
So the governor announced in a press conference on Tuesday that the school reopening plan would include a lot of flexibility for cities and towns that who want kids to physically go back to school. What does that flexibility mean?
Well, it means that local control is kind of the name of the game. I mean, and this is pretty expected by school administrators that they're going to have to make a lot of the final decisions. There are barely any mandates in the state guidance, and so that flexibility means that depending on local conditions and the kind of capacity of individual districts to follow the strictest CDC guidelines, we'll probably see pretty different scenarios, pretty different reopening plans, depending on where the district is in the state and what kind of resources they have.
Mm-hmm. And there's no mask mandate for students and teachers, but individual school districts can implement mask mandates if they want. What was the governor's reasoning behind this?
Well, the governor has stressed multiple times this week that he really didn't want to create mandates that were so strict that they were impossible to follow. And therefore, schools would just kind of resort to going remote. They would say, we can't meet the school reopening guidelines as it's laid out by the state. And therefore, you know, we're just going to have to keep students at home. And he, again, yesterday actually kind of defended the decision to not mandate any masks for anyone other than outside visitors. Here he is at a press conference yesterday in Concord.
Oh, I apologize, Sarah. I don't think we have the tape ready.
All right. Well, basically, all to say that he basically said, like, I'm not going, it's not up to the governor, you know, to kind of dictate what Mrs. Smith decides in her elementary school classroom, which is often kind of hectic anyway. You know, we don't want to make her spend her whole day ensuring that masks are on these little kids that would, in fact, distract from teaching and is not up for the governor to decide. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the vibe we've been getting so far in the explanation for why masks are not being mandated. But in my conversations with districts, certainly a number of districts, based on surveys as well as public health guidelines, are really hoping to push masks as mandatory for you know, teachers and most students as long as they don't have asthma or breathing issues.
Right. Okay. And what have the governor's critics said about this?
Well, they've said that it's too lenient, that this kind of lack of mandates will allow districts to cut corners, and it will mean that there's too much variation between towns and districts. I mean, there is already, right? Like a high schooler is going to have a very different experience going to Berlin High School versus Portsmouth versus Nashua. So we already have so much local control and so much local variation in how our schools are run in New Hampshire. But there's certainly a sentiment among the critics of the governor that this could have been an opportunity to have a little bit more cohesion, because while we know that infection rates are really different depending on where you are in the state, the virus, you know, doesn't observe town boundaries. And it could be that if, you know, Concord has a really robust screening process and mask requirements and they really keep their class sizes small, but then, you know, neighboring Bow or Pembroke actually have totally different rules, it's going to potentially be kind of chaotic for families and communities to navigate.
What about
but
two-
I will
oh, go
say,
ahead. Sorry.
Peter, that, like, you know, no plan is going to make everyone happy. And that that goes for the state plan as well as the district plan. I mean, not everyone is going to be on board with what districts ultimately decide. And for that reason, there is, you know, there is space in the state guidance as well as district's plan so far to allow kids and teachers to stay home if necessary because of health concerns.
Oh, so teachers who might be maybe over 60, for example, or particularly vulnerable because of an illness. They can stay home, teach remotely, and not be in danger of losing their jobs.
So far, that's what we're hearing. I mean, it really is up to districts in some way. Again, like they all have different contracts, and there's potentially going to, you know, be some fights between teachers' unions and their local school boards about, you know, whether or not the new arrangements meet working conditions requirements, whether or not the contract needs to be changed to reflect a change in working conditions. So kind of that negotiation between individual teachers and districts is still something that we're going to see play out in the coming months. But my understanding in talking to districts and certainly the state's message is if teachers cannot go into school because of health concerns or because their age puts them at higher risk, they can teach remotely next year.
I see. And what has the state teachers union said about the governor's plan?
They've condemned it. And in fact, they condemned much of the process for the plan coming together. There was a state task force that, you know, helped develop recommendations. There were working groups. The state teachers union even then said, we do not have a big enough seat at the table for these conversations. And so unsurprisingly, they're pretty opposed to the governor's guidance. They say, again, like other critics say, it's too lenient. There's not enough guidelines. There's a lot of shoulds versus requirements. And they've pointed out a couple things. One of them is that there's this 3-foot guidance that the state has rather than the 6 feet that we're used to hearing.
And 3 feet social distancing.
3 feet, you know, at least 3 feet social distancing among students, ideally 6 feet between staff members. There's some data that 3 feet distance can reduce transmission of the virus, but 6 feet is certainly better. And the teachers union, the largest teachers union, the NEANH, is saying we don't want to send anyone back, any students, any staff into school buildings until 6 feet can be maintained, which when people think about their school buildings, that's going to be pretty hard to do if you have all students back at the same time in the school buildings. They've also said masks need to be required and that, you know, it's really a community lift. Parents need to help their kids figure out how to wear masks and why it's important to do so, because teachers are very uncomfortable. Many teachers are uncomfortable going back into the school building with no mask mandate and with students not wearing masks.
Mm-hmm. And what about the potential for an outbreak at a particular school or in a particular school district? Does the governor or the state education commissioner maybe like reserve the right to change the plan and say this didn't work? There are more infections now because of what's going on. Let's do a statewide change to this policy. Do they reserve the right to do that?
That's a great question, Peter. It's a little bit unclear. So when the guidance was announced on Tuesday, Benjamin Chan, the state epidemiologist, made it really clear, as did the governor, that look, this is a fluid situation. You know, the governor Sununu said several times that we're in a marathon. We are not at all at the end. And, you know, New Hampshire is one of the few places where there isn't a pretty considerable spike in cases right now. And so there is a sense that, you know, should things really change in terms of the density and the rate of coronavirus infections across the state could take different action. But Governor Sununu has said the threshold for closing all schools, you know, reissuing that executive order to close everything down, to go totally remote, that threshold is really high. He says there's more testing out there now, there's more PPE, there's greater clarity about how the virus works. And so he would be pretty hesitant to shut all schools down. And this question of what if there's an outbreak, I mean, I think it's safe to say if a lot of schools are going back into, you know, back into the buildings, they might be asymptomatic, but there's going to be infections. And, you know, we've seen this already in long-term care facilities, as well as some group homes and for children, where a lot of kids have it, they're asymptomatic, or a lot of staff have it, they're asymptomatic, but there is actually, once testing happens, kind of a revelation that a facility or an institution has a bunch of COVID-19 cases. And we don't have clarity yet on how the state plans to announce that, given privacy concerns, whether the state would step in and say, you know, look, District X, you have too many COVID-19 cases in your town and in your school. You guys need to go to remote. That said, there is, you know, there is a big push by the state, and certainly districts are looking at all contingency plans. So I think, you know, parents can be pretty confident that their districts are figuring out at what point an outbreak or an infection rate in the community would mean that the school would have to go remote. So, you know, everyone's thinking about this, but there isn't a ton of guidance from the state on how to do it.
Worth mentioning that Monday on The Exchange, we'll have Education Commissioner Frank Edelblue on the program. Going to spend some time diving deep into this subject as well. That's Monday at 9 o'clock on The Exchange. NHPR Sarah Gibson, what questions do you have going into the weekend still about the future of schools as pertains to this plan and COVID-19? What questions still linger in your mind? What stories would you like to pursue?
Well, there are a lot of parents who are expressing concern about sending their kids back, and they're also teachers. And I think the question is, you know, there's this notion that there will be a hybrid model in many districts, which means probably that teachers and students will be in school maybe a couple days a week. They'll rotate such that there are just fewer humans in a building at the same time to reduce the chance of transmission. And also, if there is an outbreak, for there to be fewer people who have to self-quarantine. So I want to hear from people who are making that difficult decision to just stay remote all of next year because of health concerns, but also because of concerns that there will be a lot of disruptions over the course of the year. You know, you'll try to get into the routine of sending your kid every Monday and Tuesday to school, but then halfway through, the school will have to go remote, or it'll just be too confusing to navigate. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, what happens with teachers? I mean, there is this big question right now. We're hearing from the teachers unions that the current state guidance is not sufficient and that there are major fears about returning to school safely. And so we're going to have to look to how that plays out on individual district levels over the course of the next few weeks. By early August, we'll probably have a better sense of what districts are planning.
Sarah, before we let you go, I want you to give us an update, if you could, on the Concord School Board, which released its report on sexual misconduct at the school related to former teacher Howie Leung. What did the report find of the district's handling of accusations against Leung?
Sure. So it found that there was over a decade of complaints about favoritism and inappropriate relationships with female students at the two schools, Runlet Middle School and Concord High School, that Howie Leung used to work at. And it says that these concerns were not properly addressed for many, many years. It also says that there were numerous red flags that district leadership ignored. So Tom Sicca, who is the principal who resigned, who was aware of complaints against Howie Leung, you know, apparently, according to this report, had a lot of red flags, but did not, you know, follow through as he should have. So that's the bulk of the report. It is pretty redacted for confidentiality's sake, but it does really show a pattern of concerns and complaints. This person who is now facing charges for sexually assaulting a young girl while she was in middle school at Concord. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of confirmed some of the deepest fears of parents and of community members about how the district's mishandled the situation for years.
NHPR's education reporter Sarah Gibson, thank you very much for speaking with me. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Peter.
Listeners, we're talking about the week's news, and if you have questions or comments, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And let's turn now to NHPR's Dan Tuohy, senior producer for digital news platforms. Dan, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Great to be on, Peter.
So, Dan, you've been tracking the governor's vetoes for some time now. So let's talk a little bit about legislative news, starting with the vetoes. What's his record for vetoes been so far?
Sure. He was first, Governor Sununu was first elected, of course, in 2016 as the 82nd governor. The first year in 2017, he had one veto. The following year, he had six vetoes. And of course, the big watershed moment, the large number of vetoes came in 2019 when he had 57 vetoes. And that, of course, was in comparison, of course, with the legislature being controlled by Democrats and Governor Sununu, of course, being a Republican. So there's a lot more partisanship in Concord in 2019 onward. And so far this year, we have four vetoes and counting.
And last week, he vetoed several, including the eviction protection bill. What was in that bill, and what was the governor's reason for vetoing it?
This bill would effectively limit what landlords could do for eviction purposes for lack of payment of rent. Obviously, this is the pandemic is still going on. The governor said it was really unfair to landlords, given the housing market itself. He also pointed out that the housing earlier this month is a new housing and utility assistance program funded with $35 million in federal CARES Act money, and people can renters in need of help can, you know, call up 211 or go to the Community Action Program website for more info, which is capnh.org.
Mm-hmm. And what about the bill addressing absentee voting? That was also vetoed, yes?
It was, yeah, on July last Friday. This would allow voters to vote by absentee, and it would also do some other administrative stuff for election law in New Hampshire.
And just to be clear, like voters can vote for absentee ballot this year because of COVID-19. If they want, they have to log themselves as a disability. This one would have just created, you know, you can vote absentee for any reason after the pandemic, right? Is that what that bill was about?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's sometimes called no excuse voting or no for absentee voting. And because of the pandemic in 2020 in New Hampshire, anyone can register and vote absentee if they so choose. There will also be in-person voting. But because of the pandemic, if people have health concerns regarding the virus, they can pick up a ballot and do so absentee. And in the governor in this case, Peter, was just saying it's unnecessary. He called it a partisan bill that would weaken existing voting laws.
Mm-hmm. What about there was this other bill having to do with mandatory paid family and medical leave bill. The governor has said, as other Republicans have said, that this is an income tax, and so he vetoed this one. Is this the same bill as the one he's vetoed before?
It is very much a case of deja vu. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And again, the governor says he's not against a family and medical leave insurance bill, but this bill sponsored by, it was a major, major priority for Democrats in the legislature. It was similar to the one you vetoed before, and it would, participating employers would have payments equal to like 0.5%, I believe it was, of wages. And that's where Governor Sununu and Republicans say, wait a minute, this is, a de facto income tax.
All right. So those are some vetoes. Let's talk about some of the bills that did advance. Governor Sununu did sign a bill addressing town meeting matters. What was the goal of that bill?
This is one of these pandemic year related bills regarding these town and cities with Federal CARES Act funding and other notice requirements for certain public meetings. This is one of those things where these are temporary measures, if you will, to help towns and cities meet statutory requirements while they make expenditures, including, for their budgets. And, we've had some town meetings, or some towns have town meetings this summer, as we've seen. And it's, they're past a lot of their statutory deadlines or their ordinance deadlines as well.
Also, he signed into law just yesterday a major bill addressing the cost of prescription drugs. What's in that bill?
This is an interesting one because this has been a topic for years, as you know. This would establish an importation program for prescription drugs from Canada and on behalf of the state. So what this does, it authorizes the State Department of Health and Human Services to design the program and, of course, then seek federal approval for the program. And there's all the other parts of that bill that would talk about, requiring insurers, for example, to cap the total amount of paid for insulin for covered persons. Mm-hmm. It's really, I think, in the theme of trying to lower the cost of prescription drugs, which is a perennial challenge in New Hampshire and across America.
And finally, Dan, one more before we let you go. There's also been an omnibus criminal justice bill. Omnibus meaning's got a lot in it, including a ban on chokeholds. Do we know where that is now?
Yes, the governor said yesterday he signed it. This is... I forget the bill number. As even the governor, we can rest assured, even he was saying all the bills are, there's so many bills that it gets to be a numeral soup in terms of
right.
Laws. But this bill would, authorize or rather require police officers to report misconduct, criminal mischief, would also have screening for all law enforcement officers for psychological stability prior to assuming their duties. And of course, the very headline grabbing prohibition of the use of chokeholds by police officers. Mm-hmm. So that is signed into law now.
Coverage of a variety of these issues easily accessible at nhpr.org. NHPR's Dan Tuohy, senior producer for digital news platforms. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Great. Thank you.
We're taking a look back at the week's news this hour and still to come. Ranel Chella of the Black Lives Matter movement will join us. She's a member of the Governor's Commission on Law Enforcement, Accountability, Community, and Transparency. The commission met yesterday, so we'll talk about how the work's been going so far and what's on the horizon. What questions do you have for Ranel Chella about the work of the commission? About her work on Black Lives Matter, perhaps? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Or email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. The Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community, and Transparency, formed by Governor Sununu in the wake of the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, began meeting last month. It was given 45 days to submit its recommendations, but now the commission is considering asking Governor Sununu for more time to prepare the report. With me now is Ronelle Chella, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter Manchester and a member of the commission. Ronelle, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you for having me.
So broad question to start, Ronelle, how's the work of the commission been going so far from your perspective?
It's going. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, you know, but I think a lot of great information is being brought up and there's a lot of great questions being asked. So that's good.
For example, like what great information is being brought forth? What good questions are being asked?
So, I know me and Joseph Lascaz from the ACLU were both really asking about data collection, you know, for those that are stopped, detained, arrested, or even those that just sent in a warning, you know, because we think that data collection is super important. And the demographic of race is also something that is essential for information that's taken at stops, you know, so we're really pushing for answers on those. A lot of valuable testimonies, I think, have been given by former police officers, members of the community, and just people that come from all different walks of life that want to see really great police reform. So, yeah.
And what struck you about yesterday's meeting? I understand there was an extended discussion on school resource officers.
Yeah, so there was a really long discussion on school resource officers, and I think that discussion really put it into perspective, and I hope for a lot of other people as well, how a lot of us on that commission and just in general here in New Hampshire come from very different walks of life. You know, I think Attorney Jefferson said it perfectly when Director Skippo was speaking. It seemed as though we lived in two different worlds. And that was very clear to me when I was hearing how people were, you know, praising school resource officers and having uniformed officers in schools and saying that it could help bridge the gap between the children and the community. And it was something that I had just not seen in my experience and experienced myself. So it was very clear that we just come from different worlds, essentially.
Well, can you explain for those who may not be familiar the issue surrounding school resource officers? What is the role of a school resource officer supposed to be in your view?
So I think school resource officers need to be there to handle things that are to the extreme for the most part. You know, I was saying yesterday how school resource officers show up for situations that could be as big as a student being combative and, you know, like fighting with another student. And then you also have a school resource officer showing up for what may be a disagreement between a student and teacher. And I think that's extremely inappropriate, you know, and somebody on the commission said, I think that a lot of parents would be really dismayed by the proposition to remove uniformed officers from schools. And I thought to myself, well, I think a lot would be dismayed to know that their children are being threatened by school resource officers, like a uniformed officer that's showing up armed, you know, just because they might have had a disagreement with a teacher and they're having a bad day.
Mm-hmm. There was also a lot of discussion on the issue of certification. You asked about whether the killing of George Floyd had caused the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies, a national organization, to change any policies. What was the answer?
He said that they have actually looked at it. And I think that that's really important because, you know, law enforcement agencies that have a history of doing something like this, I think they need to be really looked at and like under a microscope. So I think that was a really important answer. And I'm glad that they are looking at it in wake of what's going on and not just like now, but when something happens like that, they do take a look at their standards.
And you said he, are you referring to the governor?
His last name was Pease, I believe. It's hard because like we have a lot of people come in to testify
for
the commission. So it's hard to remember. Yeah. But he was from CALEA, which is the certification nationally.
Understood. OK, so we mentioned at the outset that, you know, the Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community and Transparency had 45 days to come up with and submit recommendations. Commission seems to be interested in getting more time for that. Is the commission still pursuing maybe an extended deadline? And if so, why?
I believe so. We haven't spoken about it since that meeting where we did bring that up. And I think it's really important. You know, it's taking a lot longer than I believe a lot of us anticipated. And, you know, a lot of the public testimonies are taking a while, but they're really important. They're members of our community and, you know, professionals that can really help us put together good recommendations. And, you know, the portion on law enforcement training took a really long time. And so we're just now moving on to the portion on community and community relations. And, you know, we only have, I believe, a couple weeks left, a week and a half. We're supposed to submit our recommendations on July 31st. And so we don't have a lot of time. And just like, I remember there was a time last week where I was just kind of thinking like, you know, we're winding down and I don't believe that we've covered enough ground. And there's just a lot of things that still need to be talked about. And there are some things that we need to talk about again. So yeah, I do think that's my view on why we need more time, but I know other members of the commission agree. And, you know, we've just recently like revamped the way we're managing our time. So hopefully when Governor Sununu sees that, he agrees to give us more time.
I see. So you've advocated for better data collection, more data collection. What is topmost for you that still needs to be talked about?
I think that's something we need to circle back to, you know, simply because I've seen a lot of on this commission, law enforcement patting themselves on the back and saying that we don't have a problem, but it's clear to me and other people that that is just not true, you know? And so that's something that we need to continue talking about, because if they truly believe that there is no problem in New Hampshire, then data collection on the demographic of race should not be a problem. And we also need that because we need to see whether or not everything that we're trying to put forth has really had an effect. And I don't believe that, you know, the commission is surrounding a nationwide conversation around race. And a lot of the time, I feel like people are forgetting that and are forgetting the reason why we've come together. And so I think that's really important. And so that's something that I think I'm hopefully going to try to push for in our recommendations and kind of keep reminding people of, and hopefully also bring it up in regards to the community portion of this.
So just to put a fine point on it, when you say problem, you mean the problem of disproportionate contact of police with people of color, Black people in New Hampshire? That's what you're referring to?
Yeah. Put it simply, systemic racism in New Hampshire.
Systemic racism. Okay. And you're still having trouble convincing people on the commission that there is actually a problem with this?
Yeah. So a lot of us do believe it, but that's, you know, a lot of us are already on the same side. But there are members of course, law enforcement who, like I said, are just like committed to patting themselves on the back and just believe that there is no problem with systemic racism in New Hampshire. And like I've heard a lot of times, we're doing a great job in New Hampshire. But like I said, it seems that they don't agree with us quite yet. And I'm not sure that they will agree with us, but that's something that I'm going to keep reminding people, definitely.
Mm-hmm. The governor has signaled that he's signing a bill on banning chokeholds, among other things. Does that give you hope that positive changes is coming? He signed this bill, and is that an optimistic sign for you?
So the part of the bill that we as Black Lives Matter, me myself, we think is important is the part, the reporting of misconduct by police officers. We think that's super important. Today's actually the anniversary of Eric Garner's killing, and the chokehold that was used to kill him was actually banned as well. And with this bill, the chokehold is banned. However, officers can still use it if they believe that their life is in danger. So I think that's something that people need to keep in mind is that, you know, this same thing already killed Eric Garner and it was already banned. And so it's important for people to realize that we are making strides in regards to reform, but we still have a long way to go. But we do think that the part dealing with reporting misconduct is really important.
Mm-hmm. The public conversation about race occurring both in the media on programs like this, between individuals, is amplifying stories that have previously not reached such a wide audience. So from your perspective, do you see people waking up to what racism is and making changes? In other words, is progress being made, however slowly, in the hearts and minds of Granite Staters?
I do. I wholeheartedly believe that, simply because just even going to rallies, I see a lot of people that I went to high school with that I never would have imagined would have come out to support a cause like that. You know, I've gotten a lot of messages from people who I might have had conversations with in the past who, you know, were totally against what I'm doing and the views that I have. And people are saying, like, I'm sorry, I didn't see things like this before. And I'm sorry that I spoke to you the way I did back then. I'm sorry that I acted towards you the way that I did. I see it now. I get it. I understand. And I think that's really important. And I feel like if I'm seeing it on this scale, you know, just with me personally, then it has to be happening to a wider audience and a lot more people than I think are really understanding it, especially since protests and things like that in New Hampshire and just the conversation in general has been going on for, I believe, going on 2 months now. And that's not something we've ever seen before in New Hampshire. Of course, I'm only 21 years old, but from what I know, that's not something we've seen before in New Hampshire. So I don't think the conversation is going to stop anytime soon. And hopefully more people along the way are waking up to this reality that racism is a thing, and it has been a thing, and we're going through it.
And Ranocello, really quickly, as we wrap up the program, any Black Lives Matter protests coming up in the near future that we should know about?
Hopefully not a protest. You know, if President Trump decides to return to New Hampshire, we will be there to protest. We do have a showing of an outdoor movie showing that we're trying to do in order to, you know, keep the conversation going and really help people gain education on the issue.
And when is
that? But other than that, probably, I believe it's next Friday.
Next Friday.
We're still working out the details for it. Yeah. But other than that, we do not have any protests planned. Hopefully it stays that way, you know, just because people always want to say, like, when's the next protest? When's the next protest? So, yeah.
All right. Well, Ranocello, co-organizer of Black Lives Matter Manchester, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Ranocello also serves on the Commission on Law Enforcement, Accountability, Community, and Transparency formed by Governor Sununu. We've been covering that commission. You can find all the coverage of that, plus all the stories we spoke about today on the program at nhpr.org. Show's producers are Jessica Hunt, Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Jane Vaughn is a production fellow for The Exchange. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.